The Columbus Quincentennial in 1992 sparked a renewed interest in looking at the history of this country from the Native American point of view. Columbus never made it to Wisconsin. But Jean Nicolet did in 1634. Technically, we should wait another 141 years until the Nicolet Quincentennial to learn about the people he met here. Or should we?
Discovered? The Menominee had been living here almost 5,000 years before Nicolet landed. Celebrate? In the 1800s, the Winnebago people were loaded into boxcars like cattle and shipped out west. Hundreds of my people died. The Menominee literally had their reservation canceled, their rights as Native American people terminated, the treaties ignored. But our people, who met Nicolet in 1634, the Ho-Chunkra, or Winnebago, and the Omaha-Nominewuk, the Menominee, are alive and well and living in Wisconsin. But it hasn't always been easy.
But they've managed to remain, despite the influx of non-Indians who followed in the wake of Nicolet.
We know that this is our origin, that this is our place of our creation of the Winnebago people, and we call this Mogoshuch, Red Banks.
At the time when this Nicolet landed here, he gave us all kinds of goods and everything that a person needs to make a home of copies of the white man world. The chief thought, this man that came, the God sent him here with all his equipment for the Indian people.
The details of Nicolet's 1634 visit to the Red Banks coastland of Lake Michigan's Green Bay are lost in the mists of time. Nicolet had been sent by Samuel de Champlain to find a way around the Winnebago, who were a barrier to French fur trade expansion. It was a low-budget expedition. Nicolet was the only European, accompanied by a few Hurons. A Winnebago told anthropologist Paul Radin one account in 1910.
No, I just got away. I drew it on it.
The Indians said they are thunderbirds. They have never heard a report of a gun before that time, and that is why they thought they were thunderbirds.
The Winnebago had a fierce reputation. They had killed an earlier expedition of Ottawas who had come to them on behalf of the French.
French did not know what tobacco was, and therefore did not know what to do with it. Some of the Winnebagoes poured tobacco on their head.
Tobacco is a gift from the Creator, and it is used in a respectful manner, sometimes to show honor and respect, and to ask for a safe return from battle or a long journey. I hear people say sometimes, what if the native people of this land had joined forces and turned back the first European invaders? But for us, that really wasn't an option. The future foretold that one day, the fair-skinned hairy ones would come, and when they arrived, they would be tired and in need of food and shelter. We were instructed to provide or assist these people with their physical needs.
Each of the chief men made a feast for him. And at one of these banquets, they served at least 6 core beavers. The peace was concluded, he returned to the Hurons.
The French were soon after preoccupied by conflicts with the Iroquois to the east, but they didn't forget those furs.
For millions of other Native Americans, first contact with Europeans was via their germ culture. By the time Nicolet arrived, European diseases had spread north from the Spanish settlements. Some estimates say as many as 95% of our Native American people were killed by these European invaders.
The Europeans had developed immunities to these diseases, though carried through person-to-person contact, they had their origins in European domestic animals. Native Americans had few domestic animals, thus no immunity.
Wasn't there a science fiction movie, something like that, where invisible microbes defeated the invaders? Only in our case, it was the invaded who suffered. The Winnebago people, after Nicolet's visit, suffered a great epidemic. One quarter of the Menominee were killed in an 1834 smallpox epidemic. Those who survived saw their world changing.
When the French returned in the 1650s and 60s, they brought hatchets, kettles, and glass beads to trade for beaver pelts. Unlike Columbus and his compatriots 150 years earlier, the French never enslaved or demanded gold payments from the indigenous people. But they did want furs to satisfy the European demand for beaver hats. And in the end, this transformed the Winnebago and Menominee way of life. In 1634, the Winnebago had one large village at Red Banks and relied heavily on gardening for food. Across Green Bay lived the Menominee, the wild rice people. Over the next 20 years, many tribes from the east and north were driven into Wisconsin by Iroquois hostilities in the east.
But our people didn't call their land Wisconsin. It's sort of like Nicolet's Landing. No one's really sure of the details. There are at least 17 Indian and non-Indian explanations for the word. In 1673, someone told Father Marquette that he was traveling on the Meskousing River. It wasn't until the 1820s that the name was applied to the land. The Menominees have been here almost 5,000 years. That means Wisconsin's only about 3% of their history. Trade goods from the French were given on credit, usually in the fall of the year, to be paid off in furs in the spring. The Winnebago were drawn away from Green Bay and their later village on Lake Winnebago when Portage and Prairie du Chien became trade centers. The Menominee also broke into smaller fur-seeking bands, abandoned their old patterns of village life, and moved nearer to trading posts.
Trade with the non-Indians continued when the British took over from the French in 1763. After the War of 1812 ended, the United States turned its attention to the land of the Winnebago and Menominee. First, they disrupted the fur trade pattern the tribes had come to depend on. Then, they started to settle in the area in large numbers.
As I stand here and look at all of the dancers that are here at the Black River Powwow, it's especially gratifying to see that we're still here. We've had a long struggle to remain here in Wisconsin ever since 1634. We look back today and wonder why Native American people gave up their lands. Well, we as Winnebago people feel that we haven't. The Treaty of 1837 is a treaty that we dispute because the people who were involved in the signing of that treaty had no authority to be there.
In earlier treaties signed in 1829 and 1832, the Winnebago had given up their land south and east of the Wisconsin River. But the U.S. government representatives were so anxious to get the 1837 treaty signed that they coerced an unauthorized group of Winnebago men to sign it. Among them were the respected Thunder Clan chiefs Yellow Thunder and Karamoni. But of the 20 signers, only two were from the Bear Clan, the Winnebagos responsible for land negotiation. The government ignored their protests. 3 years later, in 1840, the Winnebago were forcibly removed, many on riverboats, from their ancestral Wisconsin lands to Iowa.
But there was always a group of Winnebagos that made their way back to the homelands here in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Band of Winnebagoes are descendants of the renegades or rebel faction of the Winnebago tribe that refused to move out west as the reservations were established for them. Dandy and Yellow Thunder, co-leaders of the Winnebagoes living in the 1837 session area, led our people back here.
Over the next 30 years, the Winnebago were removed four more times, yet they always made their way back despite severe hardships.
They were put in a corral by soldiers, and then they were put on a train to go west. And the train would stop in the evening, and they'd kill a cow, and then they'd cut it in half. They'd just put the whole thing in, hide and all, into a cauldron. And that's what the folks ate.
We are talking about presidents. Oh, we all thought Abraham Lincoln was just such a wonderful president because he's freed the slaves and says, Uncle John, hey, I don't want to hear you mention that. He's the one that removed our people from here during his presidency.
By the time Lincoln was elected president, the Menominee were settling in at their reservation along the Wolf River. They, too, had resisted removal from Wisconsin.
At one time, the Menominees claimed 9.3 million acres of land in an area from approximately Milwaukee over to the Wisconsin River, eastern part of Wisconsin, eastern half of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Now we have approximately 230,000 square acres of land. It's about 1/89 of what we originally claimed as our ancestral homeland.
Oshkosh was the principal chief of the Menominees during the treaty period. He negotiated brilliantly on their behalf, partially because he was an expert at stalling. This was very evident in 1848, when the tribe relinquished the remainder of their Wisconsin land in exchange for 600,000 acres in Minnesota.
But then our chief Oshkosh sent a delegation out to that Crow-Wing country in Minnesota. They were gone 3 years.
This maybe might be a key to what has helped us survive
all of the onslaughts
on our culture and our land. We give the appearance that we're going along with this and we like it, like Chief Oshkosh putting on the hat and going to Washington, and everybody's thinking, well, boy, we got these people now, you know, and it's been a kind of a sneaky resistance, a passive resistance, if you want to call it.
And they come back, they said, that's not a place for us to go. There's constant war out there, there's no game, there's no trees, there's no rivers. So Chief Oshkosh said, we're going to stay here, we're not going to move.
The Menominee leaders had another place in mind for their people, a portion of their ancestral land west of their Green Bay village site, Wolf River Country.
And at that time, it was deemed by the old government agents to be a place only fit for Indians to live on. And you look at the land today, Menominee Reservation, and compare it to the rest of the state of Wisconsin, you'll see that those people were smarter than what they were given credit for. Conglomeration of rivers, lakes, game, hilly country, forest, species of trees, herbs, stuff like that, and medicines that they knew what they were doing. And there's no place like this that exists in the whole country anymore.
And they looked around and they said, well, here's, well, we got to make a living off. We got to make a go of it. Mm-hmm. We got to cut from the east and cut to the west, but we got to do it at such a speed. So when we get to the west, we always have timber to cut. But to say that at such a time when people viewed the resource as inexhaustible is just, it's kind of mind-boggling to me.
It was the Paul Bunyan era in the rest of Wisconsin. Non-Indian lumber interests, known as the Pine Ring, were clear-cutting most of the northern part of the state. They soon had their eye on Menominee lands.
Since 1854, there have been 17 known attempts by outside interests that wanted to come in and take this forest and cut it. And the tribe has resisted each and every one of those. They had that vision into the future that this is what they wanted. What you see here today is what they wanted for their grandchildren's grandchildren.
Most of the Winnebago people who lived in the 1829 and 1832 land session areas ended up on a Nebraska reservation. But those who lived in the 1837 session area resisted removal. The right to claim land under the Homestead Act was extended to these Wisconsin Winnebago in 1874.
The Wisconsin Winnebago were finally recognized by the U.S. government as being residents of the land that we'd called home for hundreds, even thousands of years.
120 years later, the Winnebago and Menominee will soon carry their traditions into the 21st century. They are sovereign nations, yet their people have also participated in the American experience.
Here at Menominee, you see, as we have our processional, our grand entry, and we have the Veterans Dance. Here at the Menominee Reservation, Menominee County, we have the largest group of veterans of any county in the state on a per capita basis. All the men that carry in the flags are veterans. Most of them are combat veterans and served in World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Panama, Desert Storm. Some are also veterans of some of the other conflicts that we've had. Wounded Knee, the Novitiate Takeover, Oka, some of the other conflicts that took place between the tribes and the governments, as we exercised our rights as human beings to exist on this planet.
It seems ironic that a people who have been so harshly treated by the federal government would also be some of its most dedicated soldiers. Perhaps the warrior spirit of their Menominee and Winnebago ancestors fuels this patriotism. A different facet of the American system is enthusiastically supported by Menominee Ada Deer.
We live in a very dynamic society. It's very important for people to understand that we can speak up, we can speak out, and we can take action. And the Menominee Restoration Act is concrete demonstration of a group of citizens working through the system to achieve justice.
Since 1973, we've made some major strides with our forest and our lands. You see now that as you look through the forest, we've increased the number of standing board feet in our forest. You see how we use the forest here at the powwow as we make that spiritual connection with Mother Earth by dancing here under the trees, the native trees to our land. As we dance, we keep in mind that if it wasn't for these trees and the plants that grow here, the land that we have that's ours is Menominee land, that we would not be anybody. We would not be a people.
Menominee history of forest management is a unique blend of people's conviction and legislation. This long-term forest management, Menominee seems to demonstrate well here that you can have spiritual rejuvenation, you can have economic base, you can have recreation.
The only problem is because we're more or less an island of timber in an ocean of cleared land, we no longer have those big, broad state influences of fire and the rest of it. So we have to mimic Mother Nature.
This enhanced satellite photo dramatically illustrates how the 222,000-acre rectangle of the Menominee Forest differs from the land around it. It is considered the finest example of biodiversity in the entire Great Lakes region. The vision of the elders 7 generations ago lives and breathes.
We received recently, this past year, from the scientific group in California, an award for our environmental and sustained yield management of the forest. For the last 135 years, we've been marketing timber from this reservation, and it's all been sustained yield. And that's the way it will continue.
The elders' beautifully simple idea of long ago to balance harvest with annual growth is an official forestry term now, sustained yield.
Back in 1854, when the tribe surveyed their ancestral lands, they estimated that they had 1,300,000,000 board feet of timber here. Today, we have 1,700,000,000 board feet. They've cut in volume 2.25 billion board feet. Plus their diameters and their species composition haven't changed. What if more of this same land ethic would have been applied on more of that original ancestral land? It would be a very different appearing northern Wisconsin than from what we know today.
There's 16 forest cover types that exist in the Lake States. Menominee has 14 of those forest cover types. It takes hundreds of years to develop a forest and to develop different age structures. A view like this kind of gives you a mosaic of what we have created in the last 135 years of management on Menominee. There are big trees, big pine trees. There are small clear cuts, small even age forests, small non-even age forests. Different height classes support different animals and birds and insects and all the rest of it. These are the areas that a lot of people come for their spiritual type rejuvenation, because you can look around. It's very carpet-like and soft and quiet in these type of forests. These stands here are what people, I think, perception of a pristine forest is. We're in a pine stand that has 100% crown closure. You look at them and you forget that they're a living organism, and that at one time they were seedlings, and that they're a living organism, and then they're gonna die too. You're gonna have to make some hard decisions. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, this one happens to be coming to maturity during my tenure here.
Many of Menominee's magnificent white pines are nearing the end of their growth cycle. But the conditions that created these stands no longer exist. There is no assurance that new white pine will grow up to replace them. Marshall took us to a stand that looked equally magnificent when he was a boy.
The trees are about 200, maybe 190 to 200 years old in this particular area. If you had time to look around you, you'd see stumps all over the place where the trees, or root systems where the trees had been blown over or tipped over or salvaged. In 1958, this particular area had 68,000 board feet of white pine here. Today it has somewhere as around 18 to 10,000 board feet. So the stand has really changed dramatically since 1958. When you look around, hemlock is taking over this. Hemlock, beech, and hard maple are taking over this site as the pine die in it. Nothing is static. Everything is cyclic. We're going around on this plant succession. These big trees, they died, they changed. New species are coming into being here.
But the Menominee people love their white pine forests and don't want all of them to be replaced by other kinds of trees. To fulfill this vision, Marshall looks down rather than up.
Lily of the Valley is a key indicator for growing white pine. So that's why we're putting a lot of effort to maintain white pine on this particular area.
All this is not meant to suggest that the Menominee are afraid to cut down a tree. But when they do, it's carefully planned.
What you see here is a single tree selection system of harvesting. We marked this individual tree here based on what we call single tree selection, where we remove the high risk and the low vigor trees first. Menominee's philosophy on single tree selection is to cut the worst and leave the best. And eventually, after we do that, you are going to be cutting towards the top of the batting order more good trees, because you will have improved the quality of the forest.
This unique selective type of logging requires care and finesse when the trees are cut and removed. Special trails are built for the skidders. Sawyers like Bob Johnson don't complain about the extra work, maybe because he owns the forest, along with 8,500 other Menominee tribal members.
I've worked in private in the National Forest Service at Nicolet National Forest, and you got bigger timber here. If you want to keep continuous forest, I think sustained yield is the only way to go. And that's the way I was brought up from grandfather on.
This will be it, Bob.
The advantages, of course, with the tribe owning the forest is that everyone has a say in it. The young kids are taught in the schools to have respect for the forest products and the land. I think the land ethic here is just almost second nature.
Unlike most forestry operations, the Menominee Mill does not dictate that certain species be cut just because their current market value is high. Biological diversity, wildlife, aesthetic values, and concern for future generations are more important than big profits today.
We want to make a profit, but we also want to be able to employ the people around here.
We have about 165 people here, here and at the Forestry Center. There's approximately another 180 employed in the forest operations. If you've had an opportunity to visit the plant and tour through it, you'll find that it's been computerized, laser lights. We have quality control working now and reinstituted some programs, training programs. And well, we've had people come from the European countries, Japan, and I believe from quite a few people from Canada, our neighbors to the north, viewing the reservation and the sustained yield practices. We have to prove that we can handle our own affairs, and we're very capable of it. The forest operation here and our forestry center and operations in Kachina is one of the finest in the country, and I'm proud to say that. I'm proud of the people and the men and the women who work down there. And with our tribal people here who are well-educated and who have sound ethics of the Aldo Leopold kind, this is an ecological paradise with respect to forest yields, flora and fauna, water, habitat.
Their forest has been a key element of Menominee survival in Wisconsin. It has sustained them because they have sustained it, attuning themselves to the cycles of the natural world. The tiny lily of the valley points the way for the towering white pine. Perhaps tiny Menominee has lessons to teach the world surrounding it. Historically, the Wisconsin Indian tribes have been the guinea pigs for many federal Indian policy experiments.
It's just something that you can't comprehend happening, but it did happen. We were terminated.
The Menominee people literally faced the Terminator in the 1950s and 60s, when the reservation status of their land was canceled in an effort to make them over as non-Indians. The Wisconsin Winnebago also fought for a change in federal policy. We'll learn more about these 20th century Indian battles in part two of Since 1634, in the wake of Nicolay.
Frenchman Jean Nicolay did not discover Wisconsin and the upper Midwest when he landed at the Red Banks on Lake Michigan's Green Bay in 1634. How could he? We were already living here. My people, the Ho-Chunkra, who became known as the Winnebago, and the Omaknominiwuk, the Menominee, lived on a bay called Green when Nicolay landed. But those who followed in his wake made it hard for us to continue to live on our ancestral lands, a place that became known as Wisconsin. The Winnebago people successfully resisted attempts to move out west in the 1800s. The Menominees were allowed to stay on lands that lived on for 5,000 years when their reservation was established in 1854. Although they weren't granted Wisconsin reservation, the Winnebago people were finally recognized as Wisconsin residents when they became eligible to own homestead land in 1874.
In the ensuing years, the U.S. government made many attempts to assimilate the Menominee and Winnebago into the larger society, but they always seemed to remain Indian at their core. Farming was tried with mediocre results, although the Menominee were beginning to successfully harvest their forest crop. Many Menominee and Winnebago people began working on farms as seasonal laborers, picking blueberries, cranberries, cherries, and other Wisconsin delicacies.
As the 20th century progressed, tourism became increasingly important, especially for our Winnebago people at the Wisconsin Dells. The Menominee also learned that playing to the tourists could bring in supplementary income. Neither tribe could have guessed that each would face some of their biggest challenges of their entire history in the post-World War II era.
I started dancing here since I was about 7, 6 years old, maybe. My first experience in self-expression, I mean, when you dance, it's all about self-expression, and then being in front of people, you know, that sort of joy of dancing for people and dancing for friends and things like that, I guess that was my first sort of theatrical experience.
Actress Sheila Tazi played a Sioux Indian activist in the film Thunderheart. This is fitting since she lived as a child on the Menominee Reservation during a time that bred activism.
It feels so good to be out here today as dancing with friends and relatives, because it was not so long ago we had some pretty rough days in our history back in the 1960s and 70s during the period of termination.
Just something that you can't comprehend happening, but it did happen. We were terminated.
The plan was to terminate the reservation status of Menominee lands, acting on a 1952 Republican campaign promise to get the federal government out of the Indian business and to give the Indians their freedom. The idea of termination was sold using the rhetoric of the African-American civil rights movement.
I know what it is to be refused a meal in a restaurant and a room in a hotel.
But there was an inherent flaw in this approach. The African-Americans were at that time focused on freedoms for the individual. Native Americans had their collective resource, land, at stake, and with it, their cultural heritage.
And in the 1950s, then, the policy was to assimilate as rapidly as possible the Indians into the mainstream of American life. Get us off the reservations. We take our reservations away, we're going to have to end up being like everybody else.
The work of our youth board is based on the proposition that it is hard to hate anyone you have come to know and understand.
Ada Deer was still a student when termination was first announced in 1954, but she would later play a key role in the fight to restore reservation status.
In one of the treaties, we reserved an area of land to be held as Indian lands are held, you know, as a homeland for the Menominees. These are very important words. Treaties are the supreme law of the land, and we feel that they need to be honored.
There was a psychological hurt to our people that the federal government would do that to us. The treaties meant that as long as the grass is green, the waters flow, and the sun comes up in the east, that's for all time. Did the sun change the direction where it comes up? Is the water not flowing? Is the grass not green?
The termination experience for the Menominees came at a very curious time in American history. It was right after the McCarthy era, where we had all this big fear of communism. And if you think about Indian tribes and how we live and how we think, it's communal.
Many people suffered in many ways because of the injustice of termination. Our hospital was closed. People could no longer receive educational scholarships. It was a cultural, economic, political disaster.
Menominees were particularly singled out for this experiment because Menominees had been relatively successful in the non-Indian arena in challenging the federal government and taking them to court for mismanagement of their property.
Earlier in the century, Senator Robert M. La Follette guided a bill through Congress that established the Menominee sawmill and formalized their sustained yield practices. But U.S. Forest Service managers violated these guidelines. The result was damage to the Menominee forest that is still evident today.
We won a $10.5 million lawsuit against the federal government. About $2 million went to our attorneys, and $8.5 million went to tribal treasury account in Washington, D.C. And a proviso on that was that before any money could be used for any purpose, that it took an act of the Congress of the United States to free that money up.
Individual Menominees were very poor, and there was talk then about Menominees getting a per capita payment of $1,500. Senator Watkins from Utah came to the Menominee Reservation and cajoled Menominees.
He said, in essence, you Menominees are smart enough to sue the federal government. You're smart enough to run your own business. We requested a simple per capita payment. It was about a three-line bill introduced. And then it went to committees, and he came back with about 20, 30 different sections. That was about a five-page bill where they wanted to terminate the Menominee tribe from federal control and supervision and make them non-Indians. A lot of our tribal leaders went up and said, well, Senator, we don't want all of our assets here now. We're not in a position to take care of them. We're not positioned smart enough. We're not educated enough. And it'll be a catastrophe. No, he says, you can talk all you want. You're not going to convince me. Your people are going to be terminated, whether you like it or not.
The question of termination was tied to the per capita payment. If you voted for the per capita payment, you were in effect voting for termination. At the general council meeting, about 168 or 169, I don't remember the exact vote, voted to accept the per capita payment, and in doing that, they voted for termination. And there were about five people that opposed it in any event. But that was always the vote that was taken to say Menominees wanted termination.
Now, the Wisconsin legislature, in its wisdom, the governor and the Congress and the legislature passed resolutions and made appearances in Congress stating that the Menominees were not ready for termination, but that all fell on deaf ears, that we could not convince the Congress to change their minds.
Throughout this, Menominees remained Indian people attached to the land and wanted to remain together as a tribe and a community. Under Wisconsin law, the tribe had the option to vote, and the people voted to become Menominee County.
Rather than going to existing counties, which was racism and distrust and everything else, we said, well, we'll form our own county, which is what one reason we were able to keep our Menominee lands intact.
So we became Wisconsin's 72nd county, and also Wisconsin's smallest county, and I suppose Wisconsin's poorest county. And then finally in 1961, we actually were terminated. The federal protection was taken away from us. We were no longer recognized as an Indian tribe. And it's really hard to understand the kind of confusion that resulted. Indians lived on homesteads for generations, all of a sudden found themselves having to buy that property, found themselves all of a sudden having to pay taxes, which was a totally foreign idea to them.
Some of the older people would call me with crying, with in desperation. What are we going to do? We feel like we're left adrift.
And we're at this meeting, and these ladies were all saying their thing, and this one man turned around, some Indian man, and he said, what are you doing here anyway? You don't have any business here. Your Menominees wanted to be white people. So
all we could say was, well, let's persevere and ask the Great Spirit to help us and guide us, because he looked after us, and he always does. If we pray to him and have a lot of kindness in our hearts, and that if we ask him for his blessing and look after us, he will.
Menominee Enterprises Incorporated was set up to manage the tribe's assets. In an effort to insulate this corporation from tribal politics, non-Indians held a majority on the board of directors. It was decided that the First Wisconsin Trust Company would represent Menominee miners and those unable to manage their own affairs.
It's kind of ironic that we were deemed to be capable of handling our own business and accept all the assets, but we were still not deemed ready to handle our own affairs, and it proved what we said was right. We always outvoted as a in the minority on the voting trustees and on the directors. So we didn't actually have control of our own operation. Menominee land, Menominee forests, Menominee dollars, it should be controlled by Menominees, but it wasn't.
Faced with a huge tax burden, the board decided to capitalize on the scenic beauty that was abundant in Menominee County. They devised a plan to flood a marshland, creating hundreds of lakefront lots to sell to non-Indians for vacation homes. This would bring more taxpayers into the county.
But then they're talking about issuing warranty deeds, and the Legend Lake development was starting. And we didn't know anything what warranty deeds were. We found out what warranty deeds were. It was voted on, and my mother came home from the general counsel, and she was in tears. And you know, anybody seeing that kind of thing would hurt, and I did.
You can see why the restoration movement gained momentum so fast, and why so many of the Indians, as Joan mentioned, were in Chicago or Milwaukee, could readily relate to what was happening on the reservation and could see the need for restoration.
We brought an enthusiasm to ridding the reservation of the scoundrels. So it was in Chicago where we formed drums, and then we got on buses and came up and participated in the marches.
Drums took on a new meaning at Menominee in 1970 when Determination of Rights and Unity for Menominee Stockholders was formed to fight for repeal of termination. Its coalition of Menominees from the reservation and from urban areas such as Chicago and Milwaukee proved effective.
It gave hope to the people who were on the reservation, who couldn't speak out as our people could.
That being a company town, you were responsible to the establishment, and if you didn't make the right noises or say the wrong things, you would feel like, well, your job is at stake, and if your job goes, you know, what have you got, and where will you go?
Drums was a group energized by the Indian activism of the 1960s. Jim Washnawatok led a protest at the First Wisconsin Trust Company in Milwaukee.
And he was able to state our case and had the courage to go up there and face all of the opposition.
It developed that several of us were in positions to help the tribe, and by us, I mean a number of people in the drums group who shared the same values of caring for the land and concern for our people.
Ada Deer also emerged as a powerful leader.
This meant many of us working around the clock, doing many things, putting out the newsletter, writing the newsletter, going to meetings, taking minutes, and baking cookies and selling them.
It was an all-out grassroots effort, and it was so great to be part of this movement.
We had the support from the National Congress of American Indians on our march to Madison. We had our friends in Winnebago's marching right along with us. We had migrant workers marching with us. Just all people, all tribes, and all colors were there. People had a thing that they'd like to tell us and to discourage us, and they'd say, well, the Menominee egg is broken, and, you know, Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall, and you can't put it back together again. And we had Vine Deloria came up there, and he said, well, he said, maybe that egg is broken, but one thing you do with eggs, you can make a hell of a good omelet out of them, and that's what we'll do here.
We had excellent legal assistance from the Native American Rights Fund and from Joseph Prilasnik, who was then the director of Wisconsin Judicare. Nancy Lurie, anthropology professor, and a writer and scholar. There were people in the Nixon administration that were quite helpful to us. The former Secretary of Defense, Melvin Laird, at one time was the congressman in Wisconsin, you know, for the Menominees, and he helped us. I want to point out that this was a bipartisan effort, that both Republicans and Democrats created the problem, both Republicans and Democrats helped solve the problem.
So that was white man's trick that we learned about, and that was proxies. You get proxies. And so that was part of our movement, was if we could get the proxies, we could get control of the company. If we get control of the company, then we've got the resources to really work on restoration.
Gaining control of Menominee Enterprises was an important step, but Ada Deer knew what ultimately had to be done.
In analyzing the problem, that was the only solution, a congressional act.
So, Ada Deer moved to Washington, D.C. to lobby for a restoration act, which would return reservation status to their land and Indian rights to the Menominee people.
There were no jobs, and I think that was the second Indian war that was lost, the war on poverty that Johnson tried to wage on the Menominee reservation just failed completely. Our men had all that they could do to provide for their families. So, you know, we weren't at that point where our men would have the time or the opportunity to even get involved and think about what else is going on around them.
It was mostly the Indian women who had a leadership role.
But I give them credit that if it wasn't for that group of people, we wouldn't be sitting here today enjoying the shade of these trees and the serenity of these woods that we got here. I give them a credit for bringing back Menominees to their rightful status as a sovereign nation with control of our assets, control of our land, control of our property, and control of our destiny.
President Richard Nixon signed the Menominee Restoration Act on December 22, 1973. Ada Deer's vision was not to restore things as they were, however, but to forge a new relationship, federal protection of their lands without Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs domination.
Many people said, well, when is the Bureau coming back? Excuse me, the Bureau is not coming back. Well, what are we going to do? How is it going to work? I said, we will do this. We, Menominees, will carry out the Restoration Act.
These experiences, even though they're terrible and people can't imagine genocide, the term is just so awful that it very nearly happened to us, but that we survived that. That some of the stuff just helped to temper us like fine steel, to make us stronger.
And so, expressing our tribal values, we prevailed. We changed history and achieved a very important historic reversal of American Indian policy.
Today, Ada Deer is Assistant Secretary of the Department of the Interior, in charge of the federal Indian policy she worked so hard to change. The Wisconsin-Winnebago had a different type of problem with federal Indian policy in the 1960s. Unlike the Menominee, the Winnebago never had a reservation in Wisconsin. Still, they hadn't been transformed into non-Indians, and they certainly hadn't disappeared. Millions of people were seeing them every year at the Wisconsin Dells. Yet, in their private lives, they were dealing with many of the same problems the Menominees had faced during termination.
Here we have nothing. We had to start right from scratch. We were on our own, so to speak.
Bernadine Talmadge, Lyle Greendeer, and Richard Day were all involved in the 1960s movement to formally organize the Wisconsin Winnebago.
The main purpose was to try and do something for our tribe on a whole. Mm-hmm. Like health, education, housing, you know, the whole gamut of things that we really need.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was mostly our land and Menominee land upon which Wisconsin was built, the Wisconsin Winnebago weren't receiving any assistance from any federal Indian programs. In order to be eligible, they needed to organize under the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934.
Inspired by a growing feeling among American Indian tribes that they should resist assimilation, and encouraged by a new president's Indian appointments, the acting Wisconsin Winnebago Business Committee was formed.
The thing that really makes me feel good about these people that worked so hard to put this together is we formed under 40 acres of land that was underwater almost. Swampland.
At first, there was some question whether the non-reservation Winnebago were eligible to reorganize. But Indian Commissioner Filio Nash was from a family that owned cranberry bogs in Wisconsin. He had known many Winnebago cranberry pickers personally and was sympathetic. A member of his staff found a 40-acre homestead that had been declared tribal trust land after its owner died without heirs.
That's all the tribe had, is 40 acres that nobody owned, but the tribe did.
And that was all they needed. This cleared the way for voting on a tribal constitution.
We kind of had a general council meeting in Toma where we read the whole thing to them and explained it to them all in English and Winnebago before they voted on it. So everybody knew exactly what was in that piece of paper.
We used to speak Winnebago. We couldn't find the right word, the English word. So the only word we could come up with is power.
As with the Menominees, a woman was spearheading the Winnebago effort, Helen Miner Miller.
She was teaching in Chicago at the time, Franklin Park, and she could get some of her students to help with the typing and all that.
It was the dead of winter, January 19th, 1963, when the referendum to ratify the Constitution and formally organize the Wisconsin Winnebago was held.
We spent that evening here when it was 15 below, waiting for the results of that day's balloting.
At least 150 of the estimated 494 eligible Wisconsin Winnebago voters would have to make it to the polls for the vote to be official. More than 50% of the ballots cast at Wisconsin Rapids, Black River Falls, Toma, Wittenberg, and Wisconsin Dells had to be yes votes for ratification.
We figured about we were going to get around 400 and some votes, and when over 500, we were overwhelmed.
514 voted for organization, 5 against.
I guess there were smiles on everybody's face that night. But there was something that Helen Miller said that has stuck with me. She said, I wonder if we've created a monster or something that's going to help us, our people.
Helen Miller was elected the first tribal chair, and the benefits of organization were soon evident.
We did our own study of our own people. With some of the statistics that came up, we were able to get more housing.
Although their public persona appeared unchanged, big things were happening for the Wisconsin Winnebago. They were the first Indian tribe to ever write and receive a federal grant without Indian Bureau help. In 1962, they were awarded $7,500 by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare.
What we did was we turned the money back. When we got mileage money for doing something for the tribe, we put our name on the check and give it back to the treasurer, so we had that money again. We used that many money over and over and over.
We kept recycling that.
The Wisconsin Winnebago also received a gift of 150 acres from some old friends.
The Wisconsin Winnebago built a school here, just outside of Black River Falls in 1875, because they felt that it was important, in order for their survival, that their children must learn the ways of the white man. However, they had trouble finding teachers to teach the children. In 1878, the Evangelical and Reformed Church built this mission and began supplying the school with teachers. In the 1960s, this land became the core of the tribal trust land that was created after the Wisconsin Winnebago Business Committee convinced the federal government that we should be included under the Indian Reorganization Act.
The opportunity to reorganize had been available since 1934, Why did the Wisconsin Winnebago wait so long? Some feared the possibility of losing money they felt the U.S. government still owed them from the 19th century land cessions. In the early 1970s, the Nebraska and Wisconsin Winnebago voted to accept a settlement for the disputed treaties.
I wouldn't say that was a big event to me, in my way of thinking. We got rooked.
4.6 million, and you divide that among the Winnebago population. What did we get? We just sold our birthright.
But this did end a long period of looking back for the Wisconsin Winnebago. It had been almost 350 years since they greeted Nicolet, and they were still on their ancestral land. And like the Menominee, the Winnebago were now creating a future for themselves in a society dominated by those who followed in Nicolet's wake. The Winnebago and Menominee found that their success in changing federal Indian policy did not necessarily ensure them a secure future.
Because of what you call National Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, we're able to have gaming here in Wisconsin. Now those dollars are rubbing off to where we as a tribe are able to provide a lot of things for our people that we never had.
In part three, we'll learn how they are resurging both financially and in their traditional and spiritual ways.
You know, the Great Spirit brought us here and gave us this, our sacred land here.
That's coming up in part three of Since 1634, In the Wake of Nicolet.
John Nicolet did not discover Wisconsin and the upper Midwest when he landed at the Red Banks on Lake Michigan's Green Bay in 1634. How could he? We were already living here. My people, the Ho-Chunkra, who became known as the Winnebago, and the Omak-Nominewuk, the Menominee, lived on a bay called Green when Nicolet landed. But those who followed in his wake made it hard for us to continue to live on our ancestral lands, a place that became known as Wisconsin.
The Menominee people have lived on a reservation west of Green Bay since 1854. Their elders chose the site wisely, and a strong land ethic has been upheld. The intense relationship between the Menominee and their land begs the question, how do the Wisconsin Winnebago stay together as a people? Winnebago country encompasses some beautiful landscapes. But the Winnebago people have no reservation, claim no showcase forest, hold deed to no sacred sites. They are visitors at these areas, the same as non-Indians. Or are they?
This entire region that we're viewing, this is pretty much the start of a very important area amongst Winnebago people. There was a large village located a few miles upriver from us. Just downstream is an ancient site that our people used for many of their ceremonials. The two elements of water and land, the rocks meeting and clashing here at this point. Very strong ties to this area for our Winnebago people.
Lance Talmage has a sense of the Winnebago people's long history in Wisconsin. This seems to matter more than who owns what. Since reorganization in the 1960s, the Winnebago do own some tribal trust land in Wisconsin, currently about 900 acres. Much of this is near Black River Falls, where they hold tribal powwows Memorial Day and Labor Day.
Our young traditional dancers here making his final preparations for the powwow before the dancing begins. Putting on his eagle feather bustle. This is sort of what distinguishes our traditional dancers and their style of dance. Traditional male dancers interpret a story through their style of dance.
The powwows help keep the traditions alive. These were not frozen in time after Nicolay's visit. Subsequent generations have often created their own variations.
We have all the categories here at this powwow. We'll also be seeing our male fancy dancers. This is the contemporary style of dance. The dancers have a lot more freedom of expression of themselves through their dance and through the high stepping that they'll be performing. Also, we have male grass dancers, which is a style that originated amongst the tribes of the Great Northern Plains. They pay honor to the four sacred winds. And as they dance about, the yarn or fringe hanging from their outfits is representative of the prairie grasses.
The dances are now often held as a contest with lucrative cash awards. This encourages beautiful regalia and inspired dancing.
We have women's traditional. They dance very close to Mother Earth, always remaining in contact with Mother Earth. Also, our women's shawl dancers. This is the female counterpart of our male fancy dancers. This is also a contemporary style of dance for the women. The dance originated from the butterfly dance, and the shawl represents the cocoon. And when their mate passed on, they would emerge from the cocoon and symbolize a new life, a new freedom. And so their style of dance is very expressive, using the shawl. Also, we have our women's jingle dress. This is the style of dance that is traditional amongst the Ojibwe or Chippewa people residing now in northern Wisconsin, Canada. A young woman had a dream. Her people had sickness throughout the tribe, and many people were dying. And in this young girl's dream, she was instructed on how to make this particular style of dress. And as she danced with this dress after she had created it, it brought health back to the tribe, back to the Ojibwe people. Traditionally, the dresses were made with the toes of deer, but today they use lids from tobacco cans. Lots of good activities going on along with a powwow. Many foods to sample, traditional foods or fry bread, soups.
Well, my mother does all the fry bread cooking. She makes all the fry bread.
Take care of Winnebago. Everybody, all Winnebago's make
it. Make it sweeter.
The singing is like a renewal, and being a renewal of life, but also to be together in the circle of life that brings the people together. The spirit of our people are very strong, and they're able to survive, and they're survivalists. And they will also go through this and leave something for the children. They left something for us, and now we're working to leave something for our children with whatever means we have. Gaming was one that was thrust on us, and we will use that to our best advantage, and we will also go on. Even this powwow has been funded by tribal casino dollars. We understand why that there are a lot of gaming interests that are, you know, fighting against Indian gaming, because we now know that there is a lot of revenue that is generated, a lot of monies that are generated from gaming.
Currently, both the Menominee and Winnebago tribal governments depend on gambling operations for the majority of their income.
Casinos, of course, raise a larger portion of the revenues. Bingo will hold its own, but it's not as large revenue generating as a casino.
5, you have 11. 11, 16. 15, 12, 10.
You don't have to go far in the Native American community to find an opinion about gambling.
The money was never sufficient enough under the federal programs to give us what we actually wanted. So what we are doing with these gaming dollars, so to speak, is supplanting tribal programs to where there's enough money there to fully fund the program. Our gaming operation makes more than a sawmill does. And we have a library now. We have a youth center. We're building an elderly complex. They want to emasculate Indian gaming to where we wouldn't have nothing. But realize Indian tribes, without any assets, any land, or any forest, or anything else like that, are now have gainfully employed people because of the gaming issues. They have dollars coming in.
Leaders from both tribes are anxious to point out that they are using the gaming windfall to fund education, housing, and health programs.
So where other people are using gaming for their own benefit, the Indian people are using it to help their governments and to help their people. And in this way, they're also using it to protect their sovereignty.
But some of the elders feel the money has bad effects on the tribe.
I don't think a lot of these people ever saw the kind of money that's going through them places now.
We were talking about assimilation, and I think our people that we elect have assimilated into the white society. They're true politicians.
With new economic development there, made possible through monies from the casino, the community is proceeding to take major steps that will further improve life for people on the reservation.
The Menominee are using the gambling dollars to start a tribal community college and add new facilities at the tribal school where Alan Caldwell is principal.
I think one of the things that at Menominee, and I think all the tribes across Wisconsin that are right now involved in this gaming, realize is that that's not a forever thing. And what we have to do is diversify our economies.
Wintex is the only tribally owned textile printing company in the United States.
Stuart Lone Tree is production manager at this state-of-the-art facility purchased with Winnebago gaming dollars.
Well, this is the revised seal I did for the Wisconsin Winnebago tribe. We did an Air Force job. That was quite a bit. I think it was 35,000 shirts it was. Yeah.
Their minority status has helped Wintex land some lucrative government jobs. But they're most proud of a Native American line, Wonkshik, which means the people.
When I was about 3, maybe 4 years old, I used to look up in the sky and really admire the beauty, the powder blue up there, and yet I knew that there was nothing there, that there was this space. And my father used to catch me doing this, gazing up there. And then one day he thought it was about time. He says, Netsawatuk. And when he says Netsawatuk, that was like a stick of dynamite going off in my mind, because I knew it was the giver of the mind and all creation and all life. Most of us received a good Christian education here and on the reservation, but I still had these teachings from my parents.
Well, if you've looked into the history of Indian tribes in this country, you'll find that probably about 100 years, 125 years ago, the federal government had a policy whereby they divided the Indian tribes among the operating church groups at the time. This particular tribe was essentially given to the Catholics. And the Catholics were contracted by the BIA with federal money to operate schools for the Menominee starting back 75, 80, 90 years ago.
Sister, I said,
Down in Shawano, they have a Catholic school. Do the children have the same geography? And it, the answer was yes. I was wondering why I'm here. Why I'm here, I have to sit here, I have to sleep here, I have to, you know, I have to sleep here, I eat here. I have to haul in wood and the various chores or after school chores that we had to do at the end of the day. And we had to do these, and here I have to stay here, and they are free over there. The freedom that we all look for. And then my question was, well, how come we aren't all sitting in the same classroom? If you say this, that we are all created equal and everything was based on love and a gift from the Great Spirit, God, what you teach you. I never received that until I was 40 years old. This freedom. In my mind, I was being schooled by the elders, those who were native speakers.
Every child in the school has Menominee language every day. Menominee, the language of a culture is the core of a culture. One can learn some of the history and some of the cultural traditions and some of the foods that were eaten and some of those things, certainly. But if you don't know the language, you don't know the meaning, we base our culture around the language for everybody.
This one is a funny one.
In my role here as the principal of the Menominee Tribal School, I want to try to do my part in the Menominee way to continue those traditions and see that our culture remains intact, that our culture is a viable culture, that we value it. And the only way we can do that, I think, is through an educational process such as we have here.
There are still some on the reservation who would argue educationally that those kinds of things are irrelevant, that the cultural knowledge that is taught in the school just takes time away from the important things like learning how to read and write and run a computer and all that sort of thing.
Click on pub, where it says P-U-B, click on pub.
We have an enrollment of about 215 students. With the two computer rooms that we have, we probably have a ratio of about one computer to every five students. But I think that really helps stimulate our kids' interest in education.
We also are in the process of developing the children of the Menominee's Museum to use a teaching tool. We've divided the museum into two central parts: how children were raised before the white man arrived, and how children are raised now and at this time in life, so that the children can begin to understand something about themselves. It's really important. If a people, not just Indian people, but if a people does not know who they are, where they came from, their rootedness, we find a lot of social dysfunction, which we do find on reservations. The alcohol abuse and the drug abuse and all those things. And I think a large part of that comes from just the disassociation that was attempted by policy by the United States government for years, by the church for years.
Now, Mr. Askinet goes into schools, he teaches language, culture, everything else like that, and medicine, and that's something we never had. But we're bringing back the younger people to where they can teach the older people on what they've missed in all these period of years. In 1961, when we were terminated, we almost lost our culture, what Mr. Askinet talks about here, that it was a break away from everything, that everything traditional in Indianness was discouraged at that point. But we had a group of people up in the settlement, Zor settlement up here, who during that period kept active and alive our songs, our medicines, our traditions.
You people got your way, I pray. We got our way. And I got respect for the white society's religion, which is Catholic. And
although the Big Drum religion originated with the Sioux, people like Mary Sam, who practice it at Zor, are also keeping the Menominee traditions alive. Other traditional religions, the Native American Church and the Medicine Lodge, are active at Menominee, as well as Catholic, Presbyterian, and Assembly of God churches. This variety does not surprise Steve Askinet.
There were different beliefs. There were different followings according to the clans a long time ago anyway, which people have forgotten. You know, they seem to think that the Big Drum is the only way.
And there's many ways an Indian is praying too, and I respect that. I'm sorry, I just can't sell out my way of service, prayer services. They got everything on there already. So there's nothing for me to say. You'll find all of your answers in there. We don't like that, but it's already done by some other people. Some of our elders did that. That's why those books are there.
Some of these anthropologists had come in and literally used some of these people to deceive them in getting this information, and have put it into their studies and into their books. And that's information that, as part of our religion and traditions, that only as Menominee people we should have, and these were not to be shared with other people, because there's this problem of misunderstanding, people not understanding or realizing the significance of these things from a spiritual and a traditional standpoint.
While sharing their culture can be an effective way to promote understanding and dispel racism, the Menominee and Winnebago have found there are some things that must remain inviolate. But Lyle Greendeer admits this can be risky.
I was sick not too long ago, very ill. And I thought to myself, what am I going to do with all the things that I know now that's in here? I'm just like a computer. I got it all stored in here, and it's there. What am I going to do? I don't know whether I'm going to live in another few hours laying there, wondering about it, wondering about the children. And if I do go, I'm going to take all my values, every bit of it along. What are these kids going to do? Who's going to come back and tell them about these things that I know? I mean, this is the way I felt. Then when I left, I thought, oh, God, give me another chance. Because my computer hasn't come out yet.
We had a video. My nephew had a video. And he took every bit of it. I sat on and I talked about all these things. And after we got through, I got so far with it. And I thought, what am I doing this for? That's what I'm living for. I thought if I put it on a tape and everything, maybe I might get sick, and because we're not born with anything like this, see? Get it?
For now, video is no substitute for oral tradition. The elders not only serve as keepers of the language and religion, they also bear heavy education responsibilities. Lyle takes this very seriously.
I'll go to Washington. So I went, and I was studying about looking for Winnebago books and all over I was doing. Then I laughed at myself. All these people, the educated people that are taking anthropologists and archaeologists, are learning from the books, from the white man written books. And here I got all these stories from my elders long time ago, since I was a kid, and I'm trying to learn it from the white man world? What am I doing? And I laughed at myself and I left.
This is our land of origin. This is the land where our special events took place. And our elders, like Lyle, they are keeping our knowledge together, because it's a strength from those teachings and those special places that are going to keep our tribes together.
Then we got some younger people looking into the Indian traditions also. They're interested in that. I think it will go a long ways in the years to come. But the ones that are asked the most intelligent questions are, they're in a grade school here. And I'm looking forward to, they're gonna be more Indians than maybe what we are today.
During the height of Columbus quincentenary activity in fall of 1992, a group of Winnebago and Menominee people met along the shore of Green Bay near Red Banks. Their ancestors met Nicolay here 358 years ago, a fact they deal with almost every day.
We're not even a part of this country. We're a forgotten people. They're going to have to give us a lot of help because they owe it to us, according to our treaties.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot, how many treaties have they lived by?
Count them on less than one hand.
On less than one finger.
Yeah.
If we had cameras like this and we tell the American public what they have done to us, I think there would be a different feeling about Indians.
First,
instead of thinking about us as drunkards and welfare receivers, but they made our people welfare receivers.
Indians, no matter how serious the occasion, will have some appropriate humor that will go along with it. And I said, yeah,
yeah.
Humor is important if you don't have that. And a lot of times, you know, you look a lot better laughing than you do crying.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he said, look at them Menominees. He said, they get these cars from the federal government, and the federal government gives them all these cars. So Bob says, well, why? Why do you know that, or how do you know that? And he says, well, look at it. They got all those special license plates on their cars. So they think because we have tribal plates that these cars, that the government is giving us all these cars.
We use so many times the term that Native Americans or Indian people enduring to me. Just simply means grabbing a hold and hanging on as tight as you can. But I think there's also another aspect. It's the knowledge and the intellect and the smartness of the Indian people to adapt to the dominant culture and yet still remain intact, holding on to the education and the values and so on that each tribe possesses.
And we aren't just hanging there on to endure. We're using our intellect because we have the smarts to be able to do that, to shape and plan what we want to happen as far as the Winnebagoes are concerned and as far as Menominees are concerned.
Our elders and our parents taught us how to think and how to survive, and I think that's why we're surviving now. We had an educational system. In all areas, our people were very knowledgeable in those areas. And they try to kill our educational system. It's been 500 years, and we've been trying to teach them, you know, how to live.
And I think that being humiliated over the years of some dominant society that has changed us drastically in some ways strengthens us. A lot of the people today that deal with Indian tribes are tending to respect more their traditional values.
Well, I think we're more than just survivors. If one is just surviving, one is just existing, and I think life must be more than surviving. It must have creativity, beauty, harmony, and a sense of peace in it. And I like to think that here, the children are able to grow up in peace and harmony, and the elders are able to enjoy their retirement years in peace and harmony. And that's more to me than just surviving.
We live in a very beautiful area. The trees, you know, the land. We want everyone to understand the deep connection that we all have to Mother Earth, to share and to think for 7 generations ahead. We're still here. We intend to be here.
We are people. We are one of God's creations, you might say. We aren't any different, just because our skin is a little darker. And the more I think the people here in the United States know about us, maybe the better we will all get along.
And I'd like to go back to David Martinez. We will look at all of the things the white man has. We'll be able to work his inventions. We'll understand and study his medicine. And we'll be able to do all these things. But in the end, we'll retain our beauty and still be Indian.